Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. If you've been following the news out of Washington, you know that some sort of intelligence reform sailed through both houses of Congress. But what you probably don't know is what it all means. So what should we know, and perhaps fear, about the massive changes to intelligence practices? And why is the press ignoring the details? We'll ask veteran journalist Bob Dreyfus. Also this week, George Bush has big plans for solving the Social Security crisis by partially privatizing the system. But is Social Security really in crisis, and who would benefit from Bush's plan? Extra contributing writer Seth Ackerman will join us to talk about the so-called crisis and Bush's supposed remedy. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
The so-called oil for food scandal continues to be one of the top stories in the media, despite the fact that some of the overheated rhetoric doesn't square with reality. On Fox News Sunday's December 5th broadcast, Washington Post reporter Cece Connolly tried to point out that the United States was heavily involved in oil for food oversight. Well, that didn't sit well with Fox anchor and weekend pundit Britt Hume, who countered, quote, "Oh, come on, Cece. I mean, this problem was not the fault of the United States." Close quote. Hume went on to complain that this was the UN's job, as if the United States is not part of the United Nations, never mind its most powerful member, with significant control over the committee that monitored the Iraq sanctions. Hume went on to claim that this is, quote, in dollar terms, the biggest scandal in the history of the world, close quote. That would be true if other bigger financial scandals, like this savings and loan debacle, had never happened. But a September 5th New York Times editorial urged more media caution, noting that the ever-shriller attacks on the UN play down one key fact. Quote, "Iraq accumulated far more illicit money through trade agreements that the United States and other Security Council members knew about for years but chose to accept." Close quote. According to the very same investigations that are cited to prove the UN's wrongdoing, much of Iraq's illicit income was from trade with Turkey, Syria, and Jordan. That fact is missing from those ever-shriller attacks. But the same can be said for the reporting in the New York Times. A Times story from the day before mentioned these trade deals deep in the article, as part of comments made by a Democratic senator. It's good to see the Times trying to set the record straight on this story, but their own reporting does not always live up to the standards laid out in their editorial.
On December 7th, New York Times columnist David Brooks touted something he called the natalist movement, whose members have a lot of children and leave behind disorder, vulgarity, and danger, to move to clean, orderly suburbs and exurbs where they can, quote, protect their children from bad influences, close quote. Brooks says they are more church-going and conservative than their less wholesome neighbors in more liberal areas. Natalists, says Brooks, are an increasingly important political group. To make his point, he cites the work of journalist Steve Saylor. Quote, "As Steve Saylor pointed out in The American Conservative, George Bush carried the 19 states with the highest white fertility rates and 25 of the top 26, close quote. Brooks is a well-known sucker for lightly documented and trendy demographic analysis, but he doesn't explain why white procreation is more important than that of other groups. Perhaps he was suckered by his source, who happens to be a promoter of racial pseudoscience, right-wing eugenics, and anti-gay pseudoscience. As the American Prospect Online pointed out, Steve Saylor is a forceful defender of the White Supremacist Pioneer Fund and argues that homosexuality is a disease, possibly caused by a germ. And remember those bad influences that Brooks said natalists were fleeing from? As American Prospect reveals, Saylor fleshes them out in his article. They are illegal immigrants and other poor minorities, ghetto hellions, and the public schools. After citing Saylor's article, it's hard to believe that Brooks was unaware of his source's racist and bigoted inclinations. But even giving him the benefit of the doubt, Brooks owes Times readers an explanation.
George W. Bush has been busy filling his cabinet for the second term. We were struck by something Bush said in naming his new Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Johanns. On NPR's All Things Considered on December 2nd, reporter Andrea Seabrook reported that Bush touted his selection's farm policies as, quote, pro-growth, pro-jobs, and pro-farmer, close quote. NPR followed that with one quote from Bush making his case, quote, "We will stand behind family farmers by keeping taxes low and ensuring ensuring the federal death tax is repealed permanently, close quote. But it's pretty difficult to find farmers who've had to pay the estate tax. Even farm advocates have said it's not a significant burden. So when the president makes such a misleading statement, you'd hope the media would catch it. But NPR listeners were never burdened with such pesky details. It made us recall a complaint a listener made a few months ago, after hearing NPR's Juan Williams conduct what she considered a soft interview with Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Williams responded to the listener's email writing, quote, "The interview with Governor Bush, as with other public officials, is intended to allow them to state their views and positions. That allows you and others to make an informed decision about their policies and actions," close quote. We thought it was a journalist's job to hold politicians accountable for their words. Apparently, that's up to the listeners.
It's a marriage made in right-wing media heaven. The Fox News Channel is partnering with radio giant Clear Channel. Fox will become the sole provider of news for many stations owned by Clear Channel, the country's largest radio chain. Initially, Fox will provide news to about 100 of Clear Channel's 1,200 stations, but according to the New York Times, Fox executives say that number will increase to about 500 stations in a matter of months. But this is more than a simple media business deal. The partnership will bring together two giant right-wing media entities. Fox's conservative bias has been shown in studies and reports by FAIR and other groups, and Clear Channel's politics were made abundantly evident when they sponsored a series of pro-war and pro-Bush rallies in cities around the country in 2003. Not to mention when company officials distributed a list of questionable songs after the 9/11 attacks, many of them peace-oriented or critical of the government. And the company also syndicates the Rush Limbaugh and Laura Schlesinger programs. You can say one thing about right-wing media giants. They sure know how to work together.
And finally, here's an item to get you in the holiday mood, courtesy of the group Media Matters for America. On his December 3rd radio show, Bill O'Reilly spoke to a Jewish caller who said he was concerned about Christmas going into the schools, arguing that, quote, "Christmas carols or gift exchanges being done in school kind of sets the kids up to being converted," close quote. O'Reilly's response, quote, "If you are really offended, you gotta go to Israel then," close quote. The talk show host spelled out his reasoning, quote, "Overwhelmingly, America is Christian, and the holiday is a federal holiday honoring the philosopher Jesus. So you don't want to hear about it? Impossible. And that is an affront to the majority. You know, the majority can be insulted too. And that's what this anti-Christmas thing is all about," close quote. In other words, if you object to having the majority view made the official view, get out. All we can say is good thing no one called to talk about Kwanzaa. O'Reilly might have told them to go back to Africa.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
Talk of intelligence reform has swirled around Washington for the past few months, and on December 7th, Congress overwhelmingly approved a massive reorganization of the country's intelligence infrastructure, inspired by the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. The Senate followed suit with a 98-2 vote in favor of the bill. The story has received huge media play as Beltway pundits speculate about Bush's ability to maintain GOP unity in support of the bill. While the press was fascinated by the negotiations and the political football, significantly less attention has been paid to what actually is in the bill, much less what effects it is likely to have on privacy, civil liberties, and covert operations. Joining us to talk about this is veteran investigative reporter Bob Dreyfus. Bob, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Now, this push for some kind of quote-unquote intelligence reform started in earnest with the release of the 9/11 Commission report. They offered what ABC's Peter Jennings termed a, quote, "series of well-meant recommendations," close quote. Now, that certainly sounds good, and there wasn't much criticism of the Commission's findings. What did you make of their job specifically with regard to intelligence?
Well, I think you wouldn't expect anything in the post-9/11 climate in terms of intelligence reform, except to increase budgets for spying and surveillance, to strengthen surveillance programs, and to take further measures like the Patriot Act did to curtail civil liberties. And, of course, that's what all of this is pointing to. I mean, the 9/11 Commission was initially created as a way of trying to apportion or assess blame for what happened on 9/11. And in fact, rather than sort of pointing the finger backward at blaming people, what they did was to essentially say, we just need more intelligence, more FBI surveillance, more, you know, covert spying overseas. In other words, they simply took the occasion to recommend a strengthened national security state, and that's where their report came down, and then that's where Congress began picking up for the legislation that was just passed this week, and which I expect that Bush will sign very shortly.
Now, you mentioned some of the domestic effects, and the ACLU, I think, has been good about documenting some of this, the expansion of wiretap powers, detention powers, surveillance, increased secrecy. You also pointed in some of your commentary about this about changes about how the United States might be able to behave overseas. Tell us a little bit about what you think could be some of the consequences in that regard.
Well, it's not so much changes that could happen overseas, but the further blending of the CIA and the FBI, the further blending of foreign intelligence and domestic law enforcement. Those walls have not only been taken down, but pretty much obliterated over the last several years. And so I was thinking when there was this incident of arson in Maryland the other day where some $10 million worth of damage was done at some construction site where new homes are going up. And, you know, whether this was conducted by some disgruntled builder or some environmental extremist group, the fact is that it could be labeled terrorism, and then the CIA could be mobilized to spy on environmental groups, not only here but all over the world, to start collecting and gathering information. This is, again, not law enforcement. They're not looking for criminals. But what the CIA and the FBI's intelligence units do is collect information, build files, dossiers, and so forth. And that's what's been happening more and more since 9/11. Even the police intelligence units are being beefed up to collect dossiers and keep files on people. It's very much like what happened in the 1950s and 1960s, abuses that led to controls being placed on these intelligence systems. Now all those controls are being weakened.
Now, the commentary on the bill, so much that there was, and he seemed to follow a certain script. Bush was against the reform, so many writers on the liberal side of the spectrum and pundits were rushing to support it. Who in the media do you think, if anyone, was making noise about some of these problems with the intelligence reform legislation?
Well, I didn't exactly survey all the media, but I don't think that there has been much of an attempt to criticize this bill from the standpoint of any liberal or left perspective. Almost all of the opposition to it came from the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs, because the military field that felt that its control over the big budget intelligence agencies like the NSA or the NRO that, you know, do the electronic intercepts and satellite surveillance and all of that, that their power might be weakened. So they found what they think is some sort of compromise. But the debate in the media, as far as I could see, was pretty much exclusively between the people who wanted to create a big, giant intelligence czar, on one hand, and the Pentagon people who wanted to preserve some independence for the military, on the other. So really everything else got squeezed out in that debate, and the Democrats came down, with the exception of Senator Byrd, God bless him, from West Virginia, came down on the side of creating this intelligence czar. Now, of course, my concern about that is it increases the likelihood, not that this is the first time, that intelligence will be further politicized, because this person will have a highly political job as a White House appointee, someone who's as much a policy maker as an intelligence person. And what's good about intelligence is it tends to be grounded in reality. As political as you want to make it, it's grounded at least in data collection and in information from the real world, so that some of the best information we're getting about Iraq now comes from the CIA, which is out there figuring out whether this counterinsurgency program and the resistance in Iraq and all of that is, you know, how extensive it is, and coming back and reporting on it, which is remarkably free of spin. Now, the job of intelligence, of course, is to speak truth to power. And sometimes that happens, and sometimes it succumbs to political pressure. I think this reform is going to make it much more likely that it's going to succumb to political pressure.
Now, finally, from a reporting standpoint, is it just easier to write this story this way? There's this push and pull in the Beltway and a possible inter-party squabbling. Is that just an easier story for journalists to write? Or in this case, is there something more at work? Would you, if you were to write very critically about this, would you seem opposed to the 9/11 families? Is there some element of that involved? What do you think makes reporters sort of latch on to the very easy script in this story?
Well, I think because Bush originally opposed the 9/11 commission itself, there was some feeling that Bush opposed this entire package. I don't think the two things follow, because once they created the 9/11 commission, which, as I said, did not look into the failures so much of the Bush administration pre-9/11 as it did come up with recommendations, then I think the whole story changed, and the press never really caught up with that. So it did become easier to report it as political football, in part because these changes are very subtle. It takes a fair number of words just to explain the kind of changes in surveillance guidelines or description of how the intelligence system could be further politicized. These are subtle topics. The same thing happened really during the Patriot Act. When when something passes, as Patriot did 99-1, or this bill 98-2 in the Senate, it becomes difficult for the media to oppose the kind of juggernaut effect that develops out of it. And so there's really not been much, there was not much inquiry into the Patriot Act when it was proposed and then passed, and there certainly wasn't in the case of this so-called intelligence reform bill.
We've been speaking with investigative reporter Bob Dreyfus. You can follow his work by reading his blog, The Dreyfus Report, at www.tompaine.com. Bob Dreyfus, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks very much.
George W. Bush says fixing Social Security will be a top priority in his second term. And despite pre-election claims to the contrary, it's clear that privatization will play a major role in Bush's plan to solve what many policymakers and journalists agree is a crisis. But is this conventional wisdom correct? Is there a crisis? And how would Bush's supposed remedy affect Social Security? Joining us now to dissect the conventional media wisdom about Social Security is Seth Ackerman. His article, A Fix That Won't Solve a Non-Existent Crisis, Social Security Coverage Accepts Myths as Fact, will appear in the February edition of Fares Magazine Extra. Seth Ackerman, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be here.
Well, we've been over this territory many times before, but like a zombie that keeps climbing out of the grave, the myth of Social Security's imminent demise is tenacious. Let's begin with what journalists are saying about Social Security.
Well, they've been continuing with the same line that they've had now for a good 10 years, which is that Social Security is somehow running into looming financial insolvency. So, for example, the New York Times claimed that the program is about to come under intense financial strain from the aging of the baby boom generation. USA Today talked about Social Security's impending insolvency. The Washington Post talked about how Social Security will force up future tax rates alarmingly unless preparations are made now. This is the same kind of crisis mongering that we've been hearing for a decade, even though actually, although few of these articles mention it, Social Security's life expectancy, it's the health of the program has actually improved in the last 10 years.
Well, let's get a little more into that. That's the conventional media wisdom. What's the actual financial status of Social Security?
Well, there's not a lot of controversy. The Social Security trustees put out projections every year over a 75-year time horizon. And what the current projections show is that if you assume their assumptions, which are actually quite pessimistic about how the economy will perform, Social Security will be able to fully pay all promised benefits through 2042. So that would be another 38 years. It's hard to square that with the idea of looming insolvency or an impending crisis or something about which we have to do something now. Once the program supposedly no longer pay full benefits after 2042, it can still pay a majority of the promised benefits to the extent that future benefits, even if nothing is done at that point, will still be higher than they are now. And to, again, according to these pessimistic assumptions, to fix the problem would require a tax increase that would be so small it would be, smaller than several of the previous Social Security tax increases that have been needed over the course of the program. There were similar tax increases in the 50s, the 60s, the 80s. This one would be smaller. But again, it's not even clear whether this scenario will come to pass. It only depends on, again, pessimistic assumptions about how the economy will do. For example, the trustees assume that in the next 75 years, the economy will grow, productivity will grow at about 1.6% a year. Well, over the last 75 years, it grew by about 2.3% a year. And if it matched that performance again, the problem would be completely solved.
And that 75-year period included the Great Depression in it, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Well, in your view, what motivates those within the media and without to keep insisting there's this great crisis where there is none?
Well, I think that there has been a coordinated and pretty well-funded campaign by Wall Street companies that stand to benefit from Social Security privatization. And this has been going on for quite a while, especially beginning in the 1990s. That's when you first started hearing a lot of talk about a Social Security crisis. Some people might remember people used to talk about how, younger workers today think that they're more likely to see a UFO than to receive Social Security benefits. These kinds of ideas were put out by think tanks and advocacy groups funded by Wall Street that were trying to drum up a support for privatization. In fact, a few years ago, The Nation ran an article where they quoted the head of State Street Global Advisors, which is a Wall Street investment firm that has been active in pushing Social Security privatization. And he talked about how it took a while for he and his colleagues to get people to believe that there was a Social Security crisis coming. He said, first we had this question of whether or not the system was in serious trouble. That took a while. So there has been a sort of a media lobbying campaign. And of course, I think that the press has always been skeptical of big entitlement programs, and this fits this storyline fits into their sort of preconceived notions about what the government ought to do.
I recently heard Congressman Gerald Nadler talking about how about every 30 years there's this attempt by the right to privatize Social Security. There's an earlier episode during the 60s where there was a push to privatize some of Social Security as well, wasn't there?
Well, yeah. I mean, Goldwater, who was the presidential nominee in 1964, famously said that he thought that Social Security ought to be made voluntary, which, of course, would be similar to privatization. The idea was so wildly unpopular and was sort of met with horror by most people, including, I think, most of the mainstream press, that he quickly backed off that suggestion and said that he wasn't going to push for that. But this was at a time when very few people were thinking that there was a Social Security crisis coming. I think that, the people pushing Social Security privatization are people who have never liked Social Security, whether or not it's going to be fully functioning, whether or not it has a crisis facing it. But they realize that public opinion in the United States has run the other way. I mean, Social Security is the most popular government program. And so the only way that you can convince people to back major changes in Social Security is to convince them that it simply won't be around in its current form unless something radical is done. And so I think that's what causes this privatization, this idea that there's a Social Security crisis looming.
Finally, you mentioned in your piece that many reporters are talking about how what Bush is working on is a fix for Social Security. How would Bush's plans actually affect Social Security?
Well, that's the funny thing, is that this whole idea that there's a crisis in Social Security is based around the idea that if nothing is done, benefits will have to be cut about 40 years from now. And because of that, there is this looming insolvency or a crisis. But the interesting thing is that Bush's plan, and he hasn't put forward specific details yet, but people know more or less what the thing will look like. Bush's plan apparently is going to include benefit cuts of its own. I mean, because that's the only way he can pay for this expensive transition to private accounts and still be able to pay current retirees. Bush says that he will not cut benefits for current or near retirees. Leaving explicitly open or implicitly open the idea that he'll cut benefits for people who are younger today. Well, that's exactly the problem that supposedly Social Security is already facing. So, it's interesting that journalists accept at face value that this is an attempt to reform the system, an attempt to fix this supposed problem, when even the proponents of this kind of overhaul don't claim that it would fix the problem that's supposedly the biggest obstacle to Social Security continuing to function.
We've been speaking with Seth Ackerman. Seth's article on Social Security will appear in the January-February edition of Fairs Magazine Extra. Seth Ackerman, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you, Steve.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bimonthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or would like to hear other Counterspin broadcasts, you can do that at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart and myself, Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.